trouble, and you know, trying to bridge from this morning to this afternoon, because basically I found that the kind of assumptions that I have about technology, the kind of analysis of compute, and the politics that that goes out of, weren't really covered in this morning's talks, and that I didn't really. In fact, I think that Don Haraway sort of uses systems theory, I think, in a way, as a metaphorical way, and starts to develop an analogy to how feminists can think about this, and it begins to use it to question certain kinds of things that have been done in feminist theory, such as working a lot with a presumed public-private split and so forth, and that, you know, that may be an interesting direction, but I've done something that's almost, I work in almost an opposite direction, which is that I've really worked with ecology as a metaphor and tried to think about ecology from a feminist perspective, and I think in the framework of the morning that I would be very close to being a Luddite. Probably the closest thing that you're going to get to being a Luddite at this conference. I do believe that there are liberatory technologies, but it's not totally clear to me. I don't think we've exactly figured out what our feminist way of deciding which are and which aren't would be. I think that the women against high technology who were presenting the videotape at lunchtime today are really working on making a distinction between high technology and low technology, which I think people may have seen the leaflet and so forth. And so what I want to do is talk to you. I'm going to read a little bit. I want to basically conclude this. I don't know, people are sort of squatting in the corner. My friends are squatting in the corner. So I don't know if we should. I know some people may want to be doing what you're not supposed to be doing, which is jumping in and out of different workshops. So you people can sit close to the door.
Can we ask
the
high-tech question?
Yeah, okay. It's okay with me. Okay, people from the Women's Center want to take this workshop, which is all right with me, but I said that I thought that I wanted to ask other people here in the workshop how they felt about that and whether they were comfortable with that before we went ahead. Is anyone uncomfortable with having the workshop please? We've reached consensus. So what I really want to do is try and, starting from what I've said, you know, that I think I would really differ from, you know, differ sharply with Donna Haraway. I mean, we started into this discussion last night at a cocktail party, but we never really finished it. I think it'll take a long time. And talk about the perspective that my work sort of grows out of, and talk about what I think some people expect to hear about in this workshop, or talk about in this workshop, which is feminist resistance and creative forms of feminist resistance to what we can probably agree upon are destructive technologies. I mean, I think that the kinds of things that I'm going to be talking about resisting, we could probably find general agreement are technologies that we don't want, whatever our general position is on technology. So, I'm going to start by reading you a couple of quotes which helped me as I began to think about these issues, which sort of set off some thinking for me. And one is from Nadine Rick. And she says, "We have been perceived for too many centuries as pure nature, exploited and raped like the Earth and the solar system. Small wonder if we now long to become culture, pure spirit, mind. Yet it's precisely this culture and its political institutions which have split us off from itself. In so doing, it has also split itself off from life, becoming the death culture of quantification, abstraction, and the will to power which has reached its most refined destructiveness in this century. It is this culture and politics of abstraction which women are talking of changing, of bringing into accountability in human terms." And the other is from a book called The Dialectic of Enlightenment by Max Horkheimer and Theodore Adorno, and this is that woman became the embodiment of the biological function, the image of nature, the subjugation of which constituted that civilization's title to fame. For millennia, men dreamed of acquiring absolute mastery over nature, of converting the cosmos into one immense hunting ground. It was to this that the idea of man was geared in a male-dominated society. This was the significance of reason, his proudest birth. So I'm going to try not to read to you for too long. I think this will be hard, but I'll cut it short. And this is from a paper that is appearing in a book called Machina Ex Dea, Gender Perspectives on Technology, which is coming out this spring from Pergamon Press, and it's edited by Jerry Rothschild. All human beings are natural beings. That may seem like an obvious statement, yet we live in a culture which is founded on repudiation and domination of nature. This has a special significance for women because in patriarchal thought, women are believed to be closer to nature than men. That gives women a particular stake in ending the domination of nature and healing the alienation between human and non-human nature. The hatred of women and the hatred of nature are intimately connected and mutually reinforcing. In the project of building this Western industrial civilization, nature became something to be dominated, overcome, made to serve the needs of men. She was stripped of her mystical powers and properties as beliefs and the magical powers of nature were relegated to the trash bin of superstition. You know, this is sort of the progress of rationality. Nature was reduced to natural resources to be exploited by human beings to fulfill human needs and purposes which were defined in opposition to nature. A dualistic Christianity was ascendant with the early demise of old goddess religions, paganism, and animistic belief systems. With the disenchantment of nature came the conditions for unchecked scientific exploration and technological exploitation. And this word, that what I mean from, is from a larger work called Feminism and the Reenchantment of the World. So we bear the consequences today of beliefs in unlimited control over nature and in science's ability to solve any problem, as nuclear power plants are built without provisions for waste disposal or satellites sent into space without provision for retrieval. In this way, nature became other, something essentially different from the dominant, to be objectified and subordinated. Women who identified with nature have been similarly objectified and subordinated in patriarchal society. For men, raised in woman-hating cultures, the fact that they are born of women and dependent upon non-human nature for existence is frightening. The process of objectification, of making women and nature others to be appropriated and dominated, is based on a profound forgetting of their own naturalness by men. And this is where I would see what Donna Haraway referred to this morning as, I think it was white liberal men starting to identify with animals and nature. I mean, I can understand in a way why this is, it's a funny thing, it's laughable, you might question some sincerity, but I think that's actually a positive development. If that could actually start to happen, if men could start to recognize their own naturalness, that would be a great help in terms of the ecological situation we face and the prospect of nuclear annihilation. And they forget that they're born of women and dependent on women in their early helpless years and dependent on non-human nature all their lives, which allows first for objectification and then for domination. But the denied part of men is never fully obliterated. The memory remains in the knowledge of mortality and the fear of women's power. And you see this basic kind of fragility of gender identity, what is a man, what is a woman, which surfaces when received proofs about women and men are challenged and the sexes depart from their natural, so-called natural roles. And I think that the opposition to the not very radical Equal Rights Amendment can be partially explained on these grounds. That this sort of implies that women could enter into traditionally male areas, that there should be, you know, it does something to blur gender identity, and that's part of what makes it so threatening and part of what creates some of the really strong opposition. And more threatening are homosexuality and the gay liberation movement, because they name a more radical truth, that sexual orientation, not only sexual identity, but sexual orientation is not indelible, nor is it naturally heterosexual. Lesbianism, particularly, which suggests that women can be self-sufficient, reminds men that they may not be needed. And men are forced into remembering their own need for women to enable them to support and mediate the construction of their private reality and their public civilization. And I want to say something about, Various anthropologists have worked with this question about, are women dominated or subordinated everywhere? And does this have any correlation with attitudes toward nature within a given society? And there are different feelings. But Sherry Ortner asked the question this way: what could there be in the generalized structure and conditions of existence common to every culture that would lead every culture to place a lower value upon women? And her thesis, she says, my thesis is that woman is being identified, or if you will, seems to be a symbol of something that every culture devalues, something that every culture defines as being of a lower order of existence than itself. Now it seems to me that there's only one thing that would fit that description, and that is nature in the most generalized sense. And so she says that women are situated between the two realms of nature and culture, and that the defining of nature in opposition to culture is also resulted in the defining of culture in opposition to life, devaluing life-giving functions and life itself. So I think that I'm skipping over some things, but I think that the recognition of this bridge-like position between women and nature, of women between nature and culture, poses basically three possible directions for us as feminists. And in making this argument, I'm not saying that women are more natural than men. That's really not the point. But we perceive to be closer to nature for certain reasons that have to do with what we've done, how we've lived our lives, and so forth. And what we want to make of this, I think, is a big question. Do we want to repudiate that and say, look, we're no more natural than men? We want into culture-making activities defined against nature. That's one possible direction. The integration of women into the world of culture and production. And this, the problem for me with this position, when you start trying to take into believe that some of the roots of the domination of women in nature are similar, is that it doesn't challenge or question nature-culture dualism itself, and it doesn't really make it possible to bring ecological concerns into feminism. Because if you swallow that idea, if you make part of your smuggle, in a way, Trojan horse style, you know, this nature-culture opposition into your feminism, then you become unwittingly part of the problem, in a sense. You know, when you, and I think that that's really the problem. That's something that most liberal feminists have certainly done. I think most socialist feminists have done it too, to sort of talk broadly about it. For some feminists, the severance of the woman-nature connection has been seen as a condition for women's liberation. Other feminists have built on the woman-nature connection by reinforcing it. Women in nature, the spiritual intuitive, versus men in the culture of patriarchal rationality. But I think there's a problem with this position too, which also does not necessarily question nature-culture dualism itself, or recognize that women's ecological sensitivity and life orientation is a socialized perspective, which could be socialized right out of us, depending on what we do with our day-to-day lives. I mean, we could learn to be as bad as they are. And there's no reason to believe that women placed in positions of patriarchal power will act any differently from men, or that we can bring about a feminist revolution without a conscious understanding of history and a challenge to economic and political power structures. And so what I want to suggest really is a third direction, and this is what I've been calling ecofeminism. While recognizing that the nature-culture opposition is a product of culture, we can nonetheless consciously choose not to sever the woman-nature connection by joining male culture against nature. We can use our bridge-like position as a vantage point for creating a different kind of feminist culture and politics, transforming that nature-culture opposition itself, or overcoming that, and trying to, and using that to envision really a different kind of world, and certainly a different kind of technology from what we have now. So I think that ecofeminism contributes to an understanding of connections between the domination of persons and the domination of nature. And ecological science tells us that there's no hierarchy in nature itself, but a hierarchy in human society is projected onto nature. In other words, the idea of the great chain of being is a human invention. And it's been used to justify a pecking order in human society, to say that there is a hierarchy in nature, that some animals are better than others. Social Darwinism, I think you're probably familiar with this. But That's one position. And another kind of principle of ecological science, unity and diversity, I think is useful for us to think about politically. Diversity in nature, we know, is necessary and enriching. And that one of the major effects of industrial technology, capitalist and socialist, has been the simplification of the environment. I mean, several species of life disappear from the earth every single day, never to be seen again. And, you know, we watch these debates that go on television about is a certain snail worth stopping a dam project? And they're framed in the most absurd kinds of ways, I mean, usually the ones that you hear coming up. But really, it doesn't get to what may be a more spirit. What's a practical question in that if the environment becomes too simplified, it can't support human life. But there is some kind of almost a quality of life question in this. I mean, that if certain whole species are expendable, what's the criteria for what species are worth keeping? Which ones are expendable? I mean, it raises a whole question. And then the way that capitalism uses this environmental simplification is it simplifies culture. You know, everybody has to be assimilated and be just alike, and that's what works best for marketing. There's a whole kind of impulse toward a simplifying of human community and culture. And I think that we have to really resist that social simplification, at the same time looking for some way to have a universal community of women. And so I want to say, I think that this is the conclusion, really, that an eco-feminist culture and politics, which is based on some of the ideas I've barely touched on, is beginning to emerge. And I think central is a form of direct action, which is taking direct action to affect changes that are immediate and personal, as well as long-term and structural. And I think direct action includes learning holistic health and alternate ecological technologies, asking questions about technology and resisting deadly technologies as part of our feminism. Living in communities which explore old and new forms of spirituality that celebrate life, considering the ecological consequences of our lifestyles and personal habits, and participating in creative public forms of resistance. And this sometimes involves engaging in nonviolent civil disobedience to physically stop certain crimes and machines and to stop the Pentagon. And this sort of theory doesn't convert sort of simply or easily into practice. But I think that many of the women who founded the feminist anti-militarist movement in Europe and here in the United States share the kind of eco-feminist perspective that I've outlined here. And for the last 3 years, I've been personally involved in developing, working with the feminist anti-militarist movement. So I have sort of a first-hand account, and there are a lot of other people here who I know have worked with this movement as well. So basically, there's an analysis developing that goes something like this, which is that the connections between violence against women, a militarized culture, and the development and deployment of nuclear weapons have long been evident to pacifist feminists. But eco-feminists like myself, whose concerns with all of life stem from an understanding of the connection between the domination of women and the domination of nature, are now beginning to see militarism and the death-courting weapons industry as the most immediate threat to continued life on the planet, while the ecological effects of other modern technologies may pose a more long-term threat. In this manner, resisting militarism has become a central arena for most eco-feminists. And along with this development, I think many of us have accepted the analysis of violence made by pacifist feminists and therefore begun to see creative, nonviolent, direct action and resistance as the basis of our political practice. And I think that we're trying to address both the militarization of culture, in other words, we have our own Intrepid here, in case the grammar schools are taking small girls and small boys. You know, I've been out there a few times to see that there are an unusual number of Boy Scout troops, a disproportionate number, being brought to show them, you know, look at the glories of the military, this is what you're supposed to be. They get to shoot the guns, they get to see all the weapons. There's no blood anywhere in any of the movies. I mean, you know, it's not a real depiction of what you really give. But I think that's one example of the militarization of culture. I mean, all sorts of cities that have a coastline are getting their own battleships, so that when they stop doing duty for the military in a certain way, they begin doing a kind of brainwashing duty in various cities. So, I mean, they're finding a new use. rather than mothballing them. Mm-hmm. And then I think that we're also concerned with the economic priorities reflected by our enormous defense budgets and dwindling social services. And I think together these pose threats to our freedom and threaten our lives even if there's no war and none of the nuclear weapons are ever used. And we tried to make clear the ways that women suffer particularly from war making, as spoils to victorious armies, as refugees, as disabled and older women and single mothers who are dependent on dwindling social services. And we connect the fear of nuclear annihilation with women's fear of male violence in our everyday lives. And the level of weaponry, as well as the militaristic economic priorities, are products of a capitalist system that relies on violence at every level. So I want to say, really, I want to summarize specifically the directions that I think a politics of resistance to these kind of technologies could take. And I think that this is where something of where the title, The Power to Create, The Power to Resist, came in. And one is that I think we really need to develop a strongly woman-identified culture and politics, which draws on the life-affirming aspects of traditional female socialization and which provide us with political outlets, that is, with avenues for making public some of our so-called private virtues, and for bringing some of the symbols and imagery of the private sphere that have a certain, you know, power for all of us into the public world. And I think that motherhood, female religious imagery, and lesbianism are all sources in a way for this woman-identified culture building. And you know, we can talk about, you know, each of those in whole different ways. But the second is, I think, that our feminism has to have a creative, visionary, utopian kind of quality, non-hierarchical, valuing diversity, living in harmony with nature. And I think that's where, you know, people really, you know, people taking up architecture, designing tools, doing all kinds of different things is really a part of that. And I think the next thing is that we really have to figure out some way to work both in a decentralized place, in a real place that we really live, but to build some kind of bonds between women cross-culturally and globally. And I think another thing that those of us who work with a so-called pro-life feminist perspective, I mean, I was involved in organizing this conference on women and life on Earth about, oh, I don't even know, it's been about 3 or 4 years ago. And when people told me months later, or even years later, when I ran into them, that they thought that this was an anti-choice gathering, when they first heard the title, that they thought that this was an anti-choice gathering, you know, that it was some, that finally there was a feminist anti-abortion organization, you know. And at the time, we knew that some people might very well think that, but, and we had a whole long discussion about whether we could even use a term like being pro-life ourselves. And we decided that we couldn't afford not to, that what we really couldn't do was give them those words and that all the meaning that they have, and that we really had to begin to take back and set some things straight, I mean, you know, about what feminism really is and what it's really about. But It was really interesting to see how totally co-opted certain kinds of ideas. I mean, that they're pro-life and we're anti-life is a really absurd kind of position. So I think we can't back down in any situation, even in trying to make coalitions on issues of sexual freedom. I mean, the right of a woman to have an abortion and the right of a woman to express her sexuality in whatever way she chooses are basic to feminism. And I think that we need to talk about lesbianism as a connection between and among women, and that lesbians have a powerful experience of women bonding, which is important to all women. And that we need to develop empowering, imaginative forms of feminist direct action as part of a reconstructive resistance movement. And I think that we would like our political actions to embody a non-hierarchical, personalized way of acting while linking all the issues we act on a particular issue. And I'll just give you a couple of brief examples. I mean, basically, I think I worked with a group called the Women's Pentagon Action, and we've tried to bring these different things together. I mean, sometimes successfully, sometimes with difficulty. I mean, trying always to hit all your bases on everything can either be a strength or it can make things terribly frustrating and difficult. But I think sometimes we do okay and sometimes we don't. But one thing that we did do was when there was the 1982 disarmament demonstration in New York, people remember June 12th and June 14th, we were trying to figure out how in the middle of this one issue, very important major issue, but how could we get our feminist perspective across? And I think that ways of using public space theatrically, visually, imaginatively are things that we tried to do. And we came up with a theme that a feminist world is a nuclear-free zone. And we held the globe aloft and had a whole bunch of different things that a feminist world would be, all kinds of banners. So if you saw this procession, you couldn't have missed, you know, in a feminist world there's fun, in a feminist world. I mean, there were serious ones and playful ones. There's free choice, everyone has enough to eat, there isn't carcinogenics, you know. I mean, we went through a whole bunch of different things. And women in California surrounded the Bohemian Club, which is a male-only playground for corporate, government, and military elite. I think some of them were arrested, but they were able in this way, in doing a theatrical action there, and kind of doing a parody of what went on inside, to call attention to this kind of a bastion. The Women's Pentagon action. I don't know if I'm going to skip over this. Do people know about the Women's Pentagon action? Okay, then I'm not going to go through what we did and how we did it. But basically, I think there's one example which some people may have heard, which always says to me that I think we're doing something right. It's something that's particularly effective, and that's something that happened to some of us, I guess, in our second Women's Pentagon action, which is that a woman who had never been before politically active, she said, and had never gone to a demonstration or gone anywhere, had come from California to be part of this action. As we were getting ready to leave in the morning and people were getting their tombstones, and, you know, the organizers, you know, who like to think of themselves as visionary, imaginative types, were a little crotchety. This woman was very insistent that she wanted her particular tombstone, and everybody could say, oh, there's got it, there's lots of them, you know. I mean, somebody else must have written it down, there's lots of overlap. What if she says, no, I really have to have mine, you know, I really absolutely have to have it. I've come from California to place this particular tombstone at the Pentagon. And so, in humoring her, someone said, all right, you know, we'll find that tombstone. People looking at each other, looking at mounts of tombstones, and I said, well, what does it say? And she said, it says, for the three Vietnamese women my son killed. And everything sort of stopped, you know, at that moment. And, you know, we looked at her and she looked at us, you know, and we really knew why she had come, you know, and of course we found her tombstone. But there was something about her both being able to make a political statement and lie at rest, what was like a private pain, and turn that into a public political statement that had a lot of power. There was really, I think, something of what we were trying to be about and make possible for people, you know. And, you know, I think that more recently, I thought one of the women from, is Tony here from Green Common? The woman who, okay, she's not here, okay. I also wanted to give you a couple of examples. People know also that there's been a women's peace camp in Europe, that there are now 30 peace women's camps. Is it in Europe? It's in England, right? That there are 30, yeah. And that there are four of them that are all women's, and the one that's probably best known is at Greena. And people know that recently the women surrounded the base, and there were 30 to 50 dozen, no one's sure how many. Women who went all the way around that base, a lot of people who engaged in civil disobedience, and that there's been an ongoing women's peace camp. And the woman who was, the women from Greenham are here now, and they'll be talking next week. And this one woman who was talking with us last night gave us a wonderful example of the kind of even small actions that they've been doing. And she told us that they had, I guess as part of Easter, they had something like a bear's picnic. I don't know, this is some British custom that I don't know. So evidently, all these women dressed up, went and bought fake fur, you know, I mean, here they are camping out at this base, and dressed up in bears, and they all went as different kinds of bears, and invaded the base, you know. And so they did these small actions we don't hear about all the time to just sort of make it a little more difficult for the military to carry on business as usual. And so, knowing that bears like honey, some of the women coated themselves in honey. And if they were going to do their disruptive activities, the guards would grab hold of them and let go of them. And they had a terrible time processing them. Some of them got away. But they managed to take a sort of a cultural event and figure out some way to turn it around into a really playful, surprising activity. And to even fix it so that it was ingenious in a way, and it was hard for them to even be arrested. And I mean, that was an example I heard last night of what is really a kind of imaginative, playful, evocative action. And that's sort of at the other end of the spectrum from working on government, it's in a different place, it's a different location of political action than from working on transnational policy committees and so forth. And it's not that I don't think that that's wrong, but this is a whole other kind of possible location, numbers of people. And I think the imaginative quality, and the women at Greenham, when they surrounded the base, really wove into the fence all sorts of artifacts of their personal life. And they took certain things from the Pentagon action. We sort of did that too. But we ended up with this little grave that was lying on the ground, you know, which was really quite beautiful when everyone left, but it never had the visual effectiveness of what, because we didn't have a fence, you know, but they had this great fence that they wove all these things into, and they wove like the teddy bears of their children and different kinds of things like that, and it made such a kind of statement in a way that was emotionally evocative. And I think it's a lot of, that really at some level, it's not only a kind of analysis that we need, it's some sort of macro level, but it's also ways of really mobilizing people's feelings about life, imagination, and so on. I mean, the sense of the alienation and deadliness of all the questions of scale, I think, make that kind of politics absolutely essential and essential to feminism, to both validate feelings, provide a way out, you know, even mobilize in a way people's feelings and imaginations. And I think that that's really got to be an aspect of making some sort of transnational resistance to nuclear weapons and to militarism. So I'm going to open it up for people to make comments of their own, come up with examples of their own, and talk about this morning, this afternoon, or whatever. So that was very fast. I hope it makes sense. I skipped about two-thirds of this. Go ahead.
Yeah. I have some problems with what you say. And I think my problems are rooted in the fact that you say nature is good. You have an essential position of a disorientation of that culture. I really feel this nature is good, from what you said about the disorientation position. And I guess I particularly liked Haraway's kind of thing. I guess, I feel dualism in the and the other thing is, you know, the oppression of women, to me, goes back almost to the beginning of time. It just seems to me, at least, and yet the Enlightenment, which is rather recent, was the beginning of dualism. I'm using Foucault here in his adaptation of class in the court.
Well, why don't you slow down a little? I think that I'm really interested also in having everybody be able to talk, because I think people have been read to all morning. So I'm going to respond briefly. I mean, I don't think that I was, you know, I don't know that I was saying that nature is good and culture is bad. I mean, they're all kinds of, it's possible for culture, different cultures to have different attitudes and ideas about nature. I mean, it's not, I don't think that's really my position. And my point is really more that human beings are part of nature, and that there's a certain, and that part of the problem in terms of the deadly and destructive technologies and industries we've developed, I think, is a real denial of that. I mean, I don't know how else to explain it. I mean, why do we have these things if there's really a full cognizance of our relationship to the rest of the natural world? I mean, that's really basically my point. I mean, it's probably a longer discussion, but I don't think it can be simplified in that nature is culture, nature is good, culture is bad, and that that's a dualistic
thing. Well, I got that from you in talking about the fact that you said that, you know, the domination of nature by culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's much more ambivalent. I think it's a much more ambivalent relationship, and I guess that's what I'm trying to get. I guess I'm not clear.
Yeah.
I think the issue is one of control. I did a paper called Keys and Keys, which was about agricultural research and peace, and the whole notion that we would, that what we needed was more food, so we had to do more agricultural research. And what we needed was more peace, so we had to design more weapons. And the fact is that both of those notions come out of the idea of control. And the control of nature, which is in fact we achieve, we kill ourselves, because for most things, like the fixation of nitrogen, insect control, and so forth, nature is in fact doing it. And Sinsheimer, who's a genetic biologist, says that DNA research is really, if we in fact control our own destinies, we will create a giant skylab, which requires the constant input of human control in order to keep running, and it's extremely dangerous. And I think that that's where what I come out of in terms of feminism and ecology is the whole notion of control being what's being exerted. And it isn't a question of nature being good or bad, but whether or not ultimately the control of nature, the absolute control of nature, is thought of as good or bad. And it seems to me that the dominant culture thinks the absolute control of nature is a good.
I'd like to add a little to that same attack that you're taking with an example. I live in Seattle and the Lowell Museum, and I met an anthropology student who was a 10-year librarian there, and she said, "Oh, I'm thinking of getting a government grant. Of course, it'll have to relate it in some way to that in the defense movement or something to do with weapons. We're going to give you the money." I mean, this is an anthropologist, but in order to get any money in education, you have to, in some way, twist it around. But she's the opposite of what I'm talking about. She's totally the opposite. But this is what's happening. Culture today has been experimenting. This is not the culture of 10 years ago, or 50 years ago, 1,000 years ago. Is heavily militarized. And some people come to the United States as well, along with this way, becoming munitions factory. And Israel, too. And so what is studied and what is done and what our culture is has a lot to do with where the money goes. Where does the money go? I mean, can you go into a university, Barnard, or wherever you want to go and study what you want? Unless you're wealthy? No, you have to get grants from a friend. You don't know what you want.
I disagree with that nature comes out of culture.
I come at a slim consolation. I suppose that's how I end up on the side of culture. I think people understand what you're saying. It's an interesting thought. I guess some people might even find it some sort of solace, but I don't particularly. Well, some people, I've heard this also said that sometimes the roaches will win in the end.
I don't
either.
Reagan limits what he tends to. We look at the economy and we forget what's going on inside. I mean, I
agree with what you said. I think it's interesting, too, important to think about what control means. I mean, I think it can, you can take it almost back as far as you want to mean manipulating it. That is, a lot of times I thought about it in terms of trying to imagine a time when human beings still pretty much had a capacity to make fire out of their own bodies. It seems to me fairly obvious the potential that we do have. And in the books that we all, well, most of us read in school, it always says civilization began when man started learning how to use tools, or when man learned to rub sticks together to make fire. And that's kind of an example in my mind of the difference between a direct use of our own energy, which of course has to include responsible direct use of our own energy, and manipulation of the world outside of us, which also is a form of control. And it becomes manipulation in a dangerous sense when you become dependent on that energy. That is, it's the only way that our culture, our world, can get energy is through manipulating material things outside of us, like rubbing sticks together with fire. That was a name, by the way. Well, I'm not so sure. See, there are mythologies and legends of the time when women made fire in their vaginas, and that then men stole that fire from them. There does seem to be a lot of evidence that it was originally a woman's culture where women had that capacity. So what I'm trying to say is that step of learning how to rub sticks together could have been a deterioration, a degeneration instead of a progressive step. And I just talk about that as an example of what is radical understanding of what control is, but also manipulation of material being, instead of using our own energy directly.
I'm not sure that the culture is not male. At MIT, men decide where the money goes, and it wasn't a question of how they spend. And that's what we learn in universities, is what they prioritize in this kind of science and technology, which is objective and therefore can't be sexist or have anything to do with gender. Mm-hmm. And there is a lot of military
I'd like to
thank you.
I get the impression that all these movements and all those activities are not really oriented towards the point of power. The problem is really, I think, the control of the controlled movement. And if we don't get those positions of power, we keep in the circle of the problem by doing those demonstrations, which has so much of a show to move. And it's good that women should get tied and create and build bounds, structural bounds together, and be aware of our weaknesses. But the problem is, like, I don't see this with your expression, a real path toward achieving some access to those powers. If we don't get near those senses, it's unusual.
Yes, I think that as an activist, I struggle with that all the time. How far can you go into the system before being co-opted by it? I don't know, I think there's something really important about the grassroots kind of demonstrations that Nessie's talking about that are taking place all over. And I think one of the most important things about those is not even so much the effect they have or the result they have, but the sense of power that they give the people themselves who are doing it. I think there's a feeling, anybody who's in the system, anybody who works within institutions knows how it's very hard to do anything without a tremendous sense of pain, a lot of compromise, or a feeling that you have to compromise constantly. And it's not an accident that the people who
the women who make it in the system are people like James Patrick, you know, I just don't know if women can get into that system and work their way into a place where they finally have power. I don't think they can, because men aren't going to let the wrong women into decision-making places. So I think the grassroots thing is really for me. Oh, I see. I think symbolic action is more to show. Yeah, I have a sense of symbolic action.
You can take it as an assertive, okay? But if you will say, if you will get stuck in the symbol, then you try and it has to be a process. And I see it not as a process, I see it as something which is in one point, it's concerned. I don't see it as a diatonic, it's being.
I think most people who take part in actions like that, though, I mean, I think see it as part of a process, though. I mean, people aren't, but see it as an as having some importance on its own and the empowering sense of it that you were referring to. I think that people who do take part in actions like that understand that there is an economic structural kind of power system that it's somehow at some point in some way has to be addressed. But you know, I don't. You may be suggesting what is really a different strategy from what someone
else. I don't have one. My question was in fact pointed at, I don't belong, and this is the first time I'm having contact with feminism in New York. I always read about it. I have a lot of readings and theories and all that. And that's something that I feel that women usually get up near as reading about it and see it and hear from somebody else. But when we really listen back to feelings, do we have an orientation? All we have is an ideology, but we don't have any strategy yet.
Don't give up. You turn out a lot better than you think.
I'm not a negative.
I really think it will be
more.
I know this is only an analogy, but in 1978, when Three Mile Island took place, I was the person who was a good little girl and never went anywhere to demonstrate. I voted for that goal until I was AOC. But when I read the Times about Three Mile Island, I said, this is disgusting. The government isn't in control. Industry isn't in control. They're irresponsible idiots. So I said, let me go somewhere and do something. I don't care if it doesn't work. I have to do something, because you don't have to win or lose. You have to go in the right direction. That's enough. So I found a bunch of kids in Manhattan downtown someplace who wanted to throw a rug over some barbed wire and demonstrate against Shoren and Indian Point. Mm-hmm. And so that's what they were going to do. I said, well, it sounds kind of silly, but it's nonviolent. I'll do it. I'm the oldest one there. It's really a trip. So I threw my little rug over the thing, and I put my time in jail because I couldn't give my name to protect the other people. I could, because I'm the teacher, and I'm allowed civil rights arrest. But others did, so we had solidarity and all this stuff. That's 1978, and I said to myself, oh, it's not going to work. But look at today. Congress just, was it Congress?
Supreme Court?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The nuclear industry is on its knees. It's finished.
It's not.
I wish it were.
Except
for the military.
I wish it were.
It's been dealt a blow.
I had enough people they'd done.
Like Westwood.
But the military is another problem.
But I love the way the Supreme Court said that on economic grounds, you could do it, but not on safety grounds, you know, a state could.
It worked.
But see, I think there's but also in terms of the strategy thing is not that static. I mean, I think the Freeze campaign has benefited, to use an example of something that's gone right into the legislative electoral politics and tried to use that toward a certain end, has really benefited from the kinds of actions that, you know, smaller groups have done, so-called symbolic action. There's a relationship between these things.
By creating a study, by attracting people to the and then I felt that the people who were supporting the ERA was not really creating a strong strategy. They were weakened. And if they were maybe very organized and more creative and more to the point, they would be more successful in that. See, what happened is, like, most of the time, we are too idealistic. And the other people in contact, and maybe
No, it was, but it's changed. I think they decided that that strategy, that they have to have a strategy, and that is to put the right people in office. And I think they realize they need to just have a different strategy in that case.
How do we talk about, I'm getting confused now, because partially agree with you, and I think somebody has to talk about power, where 99% of the Earth's resources are owned by men and 1% by women. I think we have to talk about power. I mean, no matter, we can put the right people in on one subject, and then on another subject they just turn around. I mean, we have to talk about the structuring of how power is, and how do we want that power? I mean, what is the alternative vision? And can we use that alternative vision to fight the power?
Can we change without having power?
Right, and if we get the power, I mean, but what kind of power are we talking about? Do we want wealth? Do we want this kind of stuff? Do we want the rest of the resources to provide it evenly? What does that mean? I guess that's the question.
I want to say one thing.
Use the power we have first. Brainwash your children, as I have done with my 30-year-old son. He's an ecologically sensitive person. That's number one.
Plenty of people have tried that and it's backfired. My parents tried that too and they had a different idea.
It changed in
that way.
They think they can. But what I was going to say is, I tried to cover a lot of, because I felt like this morning, I didn't feel like my workshop got set up by this morning's panelists, and I was trying to figure out some way to bridge that, and I covered a lot of abstract territory, which may be easier for people who are used to doing that, or who sort of know this, some of it or read before. But what I was really trying to lead up to is an idea that women potentially, and I mean women in all sorts of different places, can potentially be, I think, a culture of resistance, precisely in part because we aren't assimilated into that power structure. I mean, we certainly at the moment aren't going to make the charge of the light brigade on the 1% with the 99% of the wealth. I mean, that's not what's even practical for us to do. That's a real question. And then what are the sources of our power is another question. And, where are we located in terms of all these sets of values and questions and all of that? I mean, I myself am really inspired by the fact that women consistently are, from my point of view, better on all sorts of life issues that are about the environment, that are about, questions of health and safety, over economic growth and priorities, all of those kinds of things, on nuclear issues, on all of that. And to ask why, and how do we develop that, and exploit that, and what does it mean, or what are the forms of action that are appropriate to that? I mean, that's what I'm really interested in, is women as a culture and movement of resistance, and ways to make connections between lesbian women, mothers in traditional cultures, women who may be in church type of organizations. I mean, I realize that this isn't simple. I'm not trying to say it all just comes together in one great essential mass, but if we can find ways to do that, I really think that this is the only hope for life on the planet. And I realize that that is a really radical statement, but as I see it at the moment, that is the most likely, and that could be called, it's more of a vision than a strategy. In a certain way, but it's at least saying that there's a certain. But that's really what I think a lot of my thinking is predicated on. And I don't know if that's a vision that other people here share, that you think is possible or not possible, or what. But I would really like to see us be able to do that and move our thinking in ways to draw on our outsider viewpoint on some of the things that are some of the good aspects of traditional female socialization. And to do something with that, rather than to hope so quickly to get into the power structure and do it on male terms in old ways. And I'm including the left in that. What? Well, I think maybe that's something other people should address.
What aspects should be emphasized? What traditional aspects of women should be emphasized in really mobilizing women as a power force? Where
from where we draw our power within the culture. Certainly childbearing, healing. Women have always been
associated with healing. When you said, we could emphasize certain traditional aspects of how we deal with the socialization, we should practice that more effectively, or should we should become more into terms of traditional aspects of behavior. Is it what you mean? Or we should appeal to those channels.
Perhaps more of you have some ideas.
One thing that strikes me about this, I thought the way you set your thing out, you were saying you should avoid the usual rules.
Yeah.
And think of women as a kind of bridge between nature and culture. Which is really, I think, where you misheard perhaps what she said. But anyway, to look at what traditional aspects one might think of in mothering, it isn't ever either nature or culture, it's always both. So when you say teach a child to talk, that is both nature and culture. The child comes with a whole natural body, and the mother and other people also cultivate it. A smallpox virus is nature, a smallpox vaccination is control of nature. It's never, and I think for a mother living with the child, it's always both resistance to nature and what's going to happen, and respect for it. And there's no way that one can resist nature effectively if one doesn't also respect it. And get inability to be people. And I shouldn't put military people. And that's just one thing. The other dualism you seem to be having is either you go into places of power, or you weave teddy bears into the pen. And for some women, it may be an either-or choice like that. But I think for the total strategy, that's not the case. I think people weaving teddy bears into the pen are having an enormous effect on the power. On actually the political party of England at the moment, as I understand it, on the options they have chosen to bring before the electorate. And they're creating this culture, sort of making it up, inventing it out of what we have to try to see what we can make that's convenient and useful. And with a kind of hope and a kind of optimism that the women who finally get into power won't be left in the habit.
I think that's from my point of view, the problem with your thinking. You know, it really is, and I think even the ERA people, I mean, there's an argument about what the ERA strategy should be at this point. I mean, some people think they should go elect, you know, that they should bump off the most horrible men and elect women in their places. I mean, that's probably a good idea, but then there are other people who really think, I mean, that may be an aspect of
the women get elected.
But they would be talking about specific, I mean, I think there was a split in now, and that some of those people were talking about specific kinds of candidates. And then on the other side, you know, there were a number of people like Sonia Johnson, you know, who really thought that they should start doing more civil disobedience type actions, you know, and the fasting that they did in Illinois and the power that had, you know, it doesn't work that simply, that there's the structural attack or the cultural attack.
I was feeling that I was lacking some orientation.
Yeah.
Secondly, I was not trying to make an artistic statement at all. In a simplicity, making it simple in a strategy which has to be quite complicated and sophisticated and new,
yeah.
In something simple like that.
Well, see, I think people. I mean, I certainly feel this are feeling our way, are feeling our way into a strategy, you know, in a way. And I do think that there's a relationship between the success of the freeze movement. I mean, if you want to look for something that's like concrete, you know, and the fact that the, you know, how far that's gotten is really related to the way that people doing civil disobedience and more symbolic, and say anarchistic type actions. That there's been a relationship that people have benefited from that. There are even some people who take part in both kinds of activities. But I think that right now, I think that what women are trying to do is even develop a different way of doing resistance that's direct. And in this country, I think that some of there's a plan for a women's peace camp at Seneca, where, you know, there will be a lot of women in one place, hopefully a lot of different kinds of women, who will be talking about how, you know, feminist visions for a future and strategies for peace and so on and so forth. And Seneca is also the site, though, I mean, it isn't an accidental church. Seneca is also the site that the Persian missiles are being sent to Europe from. And the Europeans are demonstrating against the Persian missiles. So those things are going on at one and the same time. I mean, it calls attention to those Persian missiles, and it calls attention to people in the United States that they come from a real place. They don't just materialize in Europe. They're made here and sent from here and stored here. And I think that it calls attention to, it gives it a place and a location and a real flesh and blood to people who actually in the end are the workers who make the things and do it and so on. So hopefully a number of these different kinds of things can be happening at the same time. And some, if there's, as the movement gets larger, something like a strategy, it's more of a strategy in a traditional sense, might develop or it can evolve.
I understand more or less, like, when you look at the fact that Gandhi, the passive resistance, that is really well known, not just that we're starting in that line, which is about the women's movement, and when you have enough people who are willing to resist, not just like the teacher when he was alive, it gets me mad because somebody's allowed in America to be arrested for civil, what is it?
Disobedience.
I come from Northern Ireland where we are arrested for speaking because of civil disobedience. Because it's getting to our heads to free us from it. And this is what, this here, I felt like another poem is drawn strong for the Holy Garden when she said,
feminist claims that are couched in androcentric terminology and concepts, male-oriented paradigms. I'm very uncomfortable with the thought that the best that women can do is to deal with concepts like power and strategy. No one here has mentioned education, except in the context of your own child. And I think when you're talking to women as culture bearers, that one of our great responsibilities is to transform the curriculum and to bring into the curriculum the sense of what is just and moral and decent and environmentally responsible from the very beginning. Each time a curriculum is redone, it's redone in the context of male expectations of what the outcome is going to be. I was amused to hear someone mention my colleague or classmate, Jean Jordan, for Patrick. We went very different routes when we left Barnard. and yet one would value her contribution as a member of the United Nations.